So I guess you've heard some amazing lecturers today, and the lectures have no doubt covered vast fields of electromagnetic science, both the wonders of it and the dangers of it. And where I come from a medical standpoint, is obviously to do whatever we can to protect people who are suffering from the effects of electromagnetic radiation. As you can appreciate, telcos have to fit in with whatever OPANSA mandates through ACMA, and as far as they're concerned, as long as they're within the OPANSA standard, they don't believe they have anything to worry about. Obviously, we now know that the OPANSA standard is based on the ICNIRP standard, and when we look at the wording of ICNIRP, it's actually an oxymoron. The International Commission for Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, indeed, we're protected for ionizing radiation, but we're not protected for non-ionizing radiation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to share some of my slides with you. So there's an amazing way of switching to slides. And I'll take you through these slides. So here's some of the slides. Okay, so I hope everyone can see the slides that I have up on the board here, on the screen. Okay, so probably a nice place to start is with the OPANSA standard. And you know, in 2002, the OPANSA standard came into effect. And during that time, OPANSA said that they would continue to research the literature as to the safety of electromagnetic radiation, as designated by the confines of the standard. And yet, in 2017, we now see that, in spite of all the research, OPANSA continue to deny that there's any problem with radio frequency emissions within the standard, and that they will continue to assess any available information. But as we know now, there are so many studies on a whole range of illnesses, including neurological diseases and gliomas. In fact, following the recent NTP study and the Ramazzini Institute study, we now have pretty solid evidence that electromagnetic radiation in multiple frequencies, but especially in the Wi-Fi frequency, about 2.4 to 5 gigahertz, causes an increased risk of brain gliomas, as well as malignant schwannomas of the heart, as well as non-malignant tumors, vestibulomas of the ear, Okay, so you know, when OPANSA say that they don't believe that there's an increased risk in brain cancer, when a number of studies have shown that, especially over 10 years of use of mobile phone technology, which we've all had at least, then the chances of the risk of brain cancer through the use of mobile phones, and the critical number is about 1,640 hours of use, becomes highly significant. So let's switch. You know, this conference is about 5G. So let's switch to where 5G fits into this. And remember that 5G comes on the back of 2G and 3G and 4G and then 4GX. And as we know, you know, the cliche is the Internet of Things, where everything is joined to an extent which is quite alluring, where our fridges are speaking to our stoves, and our stoves are speaking to, gosh, to our motor cars, and motor cars are driving all by themselves. And to some people, that sounds wonderful. I'm sure to a lot of us, it sounds like a potential nightmare in the making. You've probably heard a number of speakers speaking about the military technology components of 5G and the clearly the dangers that 5G technology may hold over and above everything that 2G, 3G, and 4G do. And so, you know, the problem with the upcoming 5G rollout is that there's to do research, there's no uncontaminated field. All of us have actually been contaminated by radio frequency. And the problem with that is that to do a reliable research study would be close to impossible. this was a fascinating paper that came out of Russian research. Dr. Zalyu Boyskaya, almost an unpronounceable name. But this researcher back in 1977 irradiated rats with 1 milliwatt per centimeter squared, which is equivalent to 100,000 microwatts per meter squared. And you'll see in some of the RFNSA slides that I'm going to show in a minute that most of us at this very point in time are being exposed to at least 100,000 microwatts per meter squared. Even though we now know that levels over 100, even levels over 10 is way too much to be living in and sleeping in, let alone over 1,000. So this study was 100,000 microwatts for about 15 minutes in 5 to 8 millimeter wavelengths. And what was found was these animals developed what they call radio wave sickness. And the pathological findings were that these animals had nerve receptor hypertrophy and demyelination of their nerves. But more importantly, there was also bone marrow suppression and immune dysfunction. They had a lymphopenia, so low white cells. They also had an eosinophilia, so high inflammatory allergic cells. Also, they had a 50% increase in cortisol and 100% increase in adrenaline and a reduction in ascorbic acid. Always remember the highest concentration of ascorbic acid is actually in the adrenal glands. Furthermore, there was a massive dysfunction in mitochondrial working. So a 64% reduction, oxidative phosphorylation in the liver and the kidneys was reduced. And there was an increase in ATPases, and these are the enzymes that break down ATP. So it was fascinating to see that in this very early research back in 1977, already major difficulties were being found with 5G. But what I find fascinating is if you look at the bottom of the slide, it was declassified by the CIA in 2010. One has to ask the question, what was the CIA doing with this literature? So this slide I call 5G promiscuity, literally in our face, as we now know. And obviously, I haven't been able to listen to all the lectures today because I've actually been asleep. Forgive me if I'm going over material that you've seen before. But as you know, with these 5G base stations, they're going to be very close to each other because the wavelengths don't penetrate very far. But the problem with that is then they're going to be multiple small cell facilities. And you'll see that the radiation from these small cell facilities may be 50 times more than a 4G mobile phone tower. And even though these facilities look like a sort of a tea flask sitting on your desk, just like a little cylindrical tube innocuously on a street pole, the emitting power from these could be, is many, many times more than a 4G tower. The new transmitters are known as MIMO, which I'm sure you've heard of. So it's multiple input, multiple output, and that handles a far greater amount of data. But also the data can be beamed, so it's called beamforming, to focus the signals to the end user. And so wherever that end user is, like in a building somewhere or in a lift, then MIMO will find you. And so power densities over 200,000 with a 5G small cell facility are not even that high in that they could be very, very much more. But the most important thing is the sort of the triangulation that we're all going to experience, where multiple 5G small cell facilities will be focusing in on you, and the overall signal is going to be very much high experienced by the body. And so the radiation is going to be huge. There's this fascinating study by Neufeld where he speaks of 5G emitting in a most unusual way, emitting data in bursts. And these bursts are known as the peak to average temperature ratio. And there's a limit as to how high this peak to average temperature ratio can be. And ICNIRP has stated that this can be as high as 1,000 seconds. But even on 5G emitting at 30 to 240 seconds, that is enough to heat the skin. You've probably heard of lots of pathological symptoms that can result from 5G exposure. This is from a wonderful website called mdtechsafe.org, 5G telecommunications dash science. It's run by doctors. It's well worthwhile looking into. And they speak of skin damage and reproductive damage to sperm, damage to retina and lenses, immune system disruption, metabolic disruption, insect populations disappearing, bacterial resistance, and massive damage to our ecology, which could spell a disaster for all of us. Remember that the skin in the presence of 5G acts as an antenna. It acts as a helical antenna, increasing reflectance of the emissions. Oops, I found a fascinating study on gene transcription mutations. And so let me just put my thing back in my ear. Okay, and what was found was that human skin cells called keratinocytes exposed to 60G for about 6 hours, there were gene expression mutations. And these were in genes specifically which protect us from cancer, one in particular called CRYP2-cysteine-rich intestinal protein 2, acts to repress an inflammatory signal called NF-kappa-beta. And when this repression is lifted, this could result in a pro-inflammatory, pro-tumorogenesis effect. Likewise, plexin D1 and pertraxin. Pertraxin is a fascinating gene that also protects us from unleashing a chain of signal transduction effects, which can result in a cancer-driven mechanism. And this gene is mutated as well. The serpene genes, which have to do with neurological effects, can also be a problem. Earlier, I heard Julie talking about ion channel issues with... I can hear myself echoing. Sorry, I'll just talk through it. I heard Julie talking about ion channel issues. And again, here there's a TLVP2 gene, which is also altered, which can result in cardiac effects. A lot of the early work done showed that at very, very low radio frequency, there can be cardiac symptoms. And this may be one of the reasons that these ion channels are affected. And so I guess what I'd like to do is switch on to Ophans's take on 5G, which is surprisingly, and really maybe not surprisingly, is not surprising. They state that exposure levels below the limit set by the Ophansa standard. It is assessed that Ophansa and international organizations such as the World Health Organization and ICNIRP, that there's no established scientific evidence to support any adverse effects of very low radio frequency electromagnetic energy exposures to population or individuals, believing that 5G just fits in with all the other Gs, so nothing to worry about, which is really a very poor assessment of this surprisingly dangerous technology that is being unleashed. So let's just go through some of our units as I take you through, volts per meter, nanotesla, microtesla, milligauss, microwatts per meter squared, milliwatts per meter squared, milliwatts per centimeter squared, nanowatts per meter squared, watts per kilogram. So we need to know our numbers and know them well, because otherwise if you misquote numbers, we misunderstand the research. So the German building biologists talk about flux density, radio frequency in terms of So flux density in terms of microtesla and milligauss, and you can see that no concern under 0.02, and really problems over 0.5. And a lot of the early research was showing cancer sort of upwards of about 0.3 to 0.4 microtesla. In milligauss, we talk of 1 to 5. Pretty much anything above 2 milligauss is not good news. When we look at field strength in volts per meter, the electric fields, under 0.3 are considered acceptable, and over 10 are of high concern. And most importantly is radio frequency in microwatts per meter squared. We always want to aim for less than 1 and preferably less than 0.1. There's a slight concern, 0.1 to 10, severe 10 to 1,000, and extreme over 1,000. And so I thought I'd just take you through some practical examples, and I might just try and move this little box so you can see this better. I'll put me right down here. Okay, so this was some work that Ray Broomhall and I and many wonderful people in the Wilson's Creek area did to try and get this tower stopped. And if you look very carefully at about, I think it was at about, I might put my glasses on just to see this better, at about 100 to 200 meters, the 100 to 200 meters, the power density was 6.75. So that's 6,750 microwatts per meter squared. And obviously that's way above what building biologists and the Austrian Medical Association believe is safe for us. But let's move on and see some of these other studies. Oh, why isn't it progressing? Okay. So here we can see the RFNSA talks about percentages. So you see in this case 4.51%, which sounds like it's not much. But this is here, we were doing some work for people in Coogee, and you can see in Dundas Street here at a 4GX facility at 50 meters, we're now looking at 179,140 microwatts per meter squared. So you can see how we've ramped up from 6,750 to 179,000. We were helping another doctor and his wife in also in Sydney, and you can see here they would have been exposed to 207.7. That's 207,700 microwatts per meter squared. They were 6 meters from this proposed small cell facility on a street pole outside their bedroom. Here in WA, when I presented in Perth, the local people there were concerned about local towers. And you can see the existing and the proposed. These were the systems that are existing, and these are the new proposed with the NR. NR stands for New Radio 3500 at 3.5 gigahertz. And when I move the slide on, you can see initially the highest density was 152,450 at 1 to 200 meters, whereas now it jumped up to, at 0 to 50, 300,000 microwatts per meter squared, and the 100 to 200 increased. And even at 500 meters, it's still 59,150, which is 10 times more than the Wilson's Creek. But what's also quite scary is the field, the electric field. Remember, we're talking about we want to be less than 0.3. Now look at this: 10.64, 11.03, 9.05, 200 meters away, even 500 meters away, 4.72, which is more than 10 times above which is considered safe, even if these towers are 500 meters away from you. Let's move on. I was looking into what it's like for people in Hobart in Davies Street and what they would be exposed to. And Macquarie Street's just parallel to Davies Street. And I find this tower emitting 13.53% of the standard. And when we move on, we can see the existing systems at 50 to 100 meters is 121,000. 0 to 50 meters is only 15.3, which is still 15,300. But look what happens once the 5G towers, there's that NR3500, gets factored in, we're now looking at 1,342,220 microwatts per meter squared up to 50 meters away just from this tower. Once we factor in all the other small cell facilities and other 5G facilities going online, I have no doubt that we'll be getting very close to, if not above, the ARPANSA standard. Okay, and see here, you can see it more clearly. Okay. And you can see even 500 meters away, still 30,000, and the electric field at 3.39 volts per meter. Okay. And so if you haven't seen these wonderful bioinitiative charts, it's well worthwhile taking a look at them. They're easily downloadable, and I'm sure some of the other speakers would have covered them. But it's just quite extraordinary and fascinating to see how dangerous electromagnetic fields are to us, and how at extremely low frequencies, even as low as 0.06 microwatts per meter squared, that a number of authors like Oberfeld found quite marked differences in neurological functioning, their cardiac functioning problems. I mean, the list is endless. We can talk for hours just on this alone. But let's move on to what I'd like to talk to you about. So really, are we on the same page with the authorities with regard to the harm that we are suffering and this and the fact that we have this standard, but it's protecting us from being burnt, you know, the burns of radiotherapy, but it's not protecting us from the insidious radio frequency and electric fields that we are constantly being exposed to at this very moment in all the fields that are yet to come. And so this is, let's switch. There are a lot of people in our community who are super sensitive to electromagnetic fields. And this we call, as you obviously know by now, electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And these four people are the canaries of the 21st century. And these are the people who in our community, and probably 5% or maybe even more, experiencing profound symptoms, or be they fatigue or poor sleep or cognitive problems or tinnitus or facial neuralgia or even rashes and eczema. Because always remember, this condition can release histamine from the mast cells, and this can increase the chance of eczematous skin conditions. And unfortunately, our PANSA considers electromagnetic hypersensitivity as really a psychological disorder, that these people suffer from central sensitization, which is a gross, as far as I'm concerned, in my professional opinion, a gross misrepresentation of genuine symptoms that people feel when they're exposed to electromagnetic radiation. And so this is pretty much the same. But interestingly, ARPANSA does say that they acknowledge that there could be health symptoms experienced by affected individuals and that these are real, which is obviously very politically correct for them to say, and that it can be disabling. And they advise that people seek medical advice from a qualified medical specialist. And so ARPANSA quite correctly is saying that if you have an issue, you need to seek a doctor's care and you need to have your condition well understood from all points of view. But remember, this is not a psychological or psychosomatic condition. It's considered that this is a biological condition. It's not what ARPANSA and other authorities have called idiopathic environmental intolerance attributed to electromagnetic fields. This is a biological illness. And to that end, I found this wonderful paper by Professor Bell Pohm and colleagues, where he's found reliable disease biomarkers characterizing electromagnetic hypersensitivity. In Europe, they also call it electro hypersensitivity, and also multiple chemical sensitivity. So these two conditions exist together as a unique pathological disorder. And as I mentioned earlier, we see high levels of histamine, high levels of nitrotyrosine. Nitrotyrosine is basically brain protein, in this particular case, tyrosine, being damaged by an extreme oxidative substance called peroxynitrite. I call it the Voldemort of free radicals. And we can measure the damage to protein structures as a nitrotyrosine assay. We can also look at the blood-brain barrier permeability dysfunction by looking at protein S100B. O-myelin autoantibodies suggesting that myelin, which is the sheath of nerves, is being damaged. Heat shock proteins, which are homeostatic mechanisms to protect us from heat stress or heat shock, are also raised in EHS and MCS patients. And almost across the board, melatonin, which is the wonderful one-stop-shop antioxidant, anti-cancer substance regulator of our circadian rhythms, is across the board lowered. And there's also a most unusual tomographic ultrasound technique called tomosmigmography, almost unpronounceable, which was done by the French researchers, but it's difficult to get hold of this system to do here. But what I've been able to do is I've been able to get hold of these markers, which are now available at a at Neutropath down in Melbourne, but I'll talk to you about that in a moment. So Dr. Irigai and Belpome in one of their other papers found that also other markers of oxidative stress like T-bars and malondialdehyde, which is a urinary lipid peroxidation marker, as well as glutathione, which is our body's universal antioxidant. So glutathione is reduced glutathione, which is the antioxidant, the unused form of glutathione, is reduced. And oxidized glutathione, which is obviously the used damaged glutathione, is very much higher. So the ratio of reduced to oxidized glutathione suffers in that there's too little reduced and too much oxidized. And they found that the combination of these markers are often raised in EHS patients. Okay. Additional markers are also available, like 25-hydroxy vitamin D and circulating IgE levels and circulating C-reactive protein levels, especially the high-sensitivity CRP. And so in the study, 71% of EHS patients were found to have raised IgE, nitrotyrosine, and protein S100B. I probably tested about a good few dozen patients now, and across the board, I find these markers to be raised. And so the question is, if this was not a biological illness, what are these markers doing raised? Because these are markers of severe oxidative stress. So we're looking at a biological illness, an illness which has reproducible markers, which can be done by independent laboratories to help these people who suffer from EHS, that they have really a signature, they have a passport recognizing the biological, pathological events that take place in their body. And so these are some of the markers we look at, as well as there are further markers that one can look at. And so I think at this point I was asked to speak for 15 minutes. I hope that gives you just a lot of sort of an idea as to where I'm going with this. I don't want to take any more of your time. I understand the conference is running late. But I think for people who are suffering, get yourself tested, because if you get yourself tested, you know where you are. You know, this is obviously the most important thing, is to remove yourself as much as possible from the contaminating fields. I also heard there was one gentleman before me who's offering various devices which look fantastic. So however you can create sort of Faraday cages on a macro sense around your bedroom, or in a micro sense around your body, covering yourself with various materials to prevent these signals affecting you, all well and good. But at the same time, we can correct one's biochemistry and one's endocrinology, and that gives sufferers a much better opportunity to negotiate this very dangerous technology and hopefully live a long and healthy life. I thank you all very much for your time, and I hope this has been helpful to you, and enjoy the rest of the conference.